Hello and welcome to a very special episode of The Laydown. My name is Ryan and I had the absolute pleasure of chatting with Alex Bracken about her latest novel, Silver in the Bone. Alex and I talked about her YA fantasy novel that is accidentally also a little bit horror and romance. We talked about Arthurian legends, and then we talked about the world of publishing and book talk and how the pandemic shifted the way things are done. It was an amazing conversation and I had so much fun during this interview, so let's just get into it.
Hi, Alex Bracken. How are you?
I'm doing so well. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh my God. So I finished listening to the audiobook of this and said out loud to my coworkers, I need the sequel immediately.
It is a pretty mean ending. I will confess. I finished writing the book and was like, ooh, that was mean even for me.
That cliffhanger. I do love a cliffhanger though. Like, yeah, it's just, I know.
I think readers get so mad when they hit a cliffhanger, and I totally understand it. I mean, I'm the same way where I'm like, no, I have to wait. But there's something so fun about the anticipation of like what's coming next and like speculating with yourself and with your friends. It's like, can't resist doing a really big cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. Like I was just watching, Netflix has a new show called The Diplomat, and sorry, I don't think that this is a spoiler to say that the show like ends on a little bit of a cliffhanger and you're like, what's happening? What's going to happen next? And I'm now so mad that I have to wait like probably 2 years to find out.
Right.
You will not have to wait that long for the sequel to Silver in the Bone.
Excellent. Yeah. I was in my little like story graph review, I was saying that I wish like this book made me wish I was the type of person to like annotate my books with all the pretty tabs and highlighters and stuff, because I went through such a huge range of emotions while reading this book. And like, there were so many things that I was like, I want to underline that. Oh, I want to go back to that. Like, it was just this book made me feel all the things.
How is the audiobook? I have not listened to it yet.
It was fantastic. It was so good. Yeah, she did a great job. Yeah.
I got to help pick the narrator in. It was like a little bit, I always, you know, like a good audiobook narrator can like really make or break it. And so, especially with YA novels, you don't want someone who sounds too mature, but then like, it's such a delicate balance between picking an audiobook narrator. But I think the one we chose was great. I think her name is Sophie.
Yes.
I want to say it's Amos.
I think it was Amos. I'm trying to remember how she said it.
Yeah, okay. I know. I was like, it's A-M-O-S-S, I think.
Yeah.
So it's Amos or Amos. Sorry. Should have looked that up before I opened my mouth as per usual, but that makes me really happy. I know we were working on the pronunciation guide for that because obviously there are some Welsh words in the book, and Welsh is a very difficult language. And so we were like, good luck.
I have some friends who are Welsh. And so I was like, I think, is that?
Oh, well, like, you'll have to let me know if they listen to it, how we did. Because we had to like,
For the listeners who haven't gotten to read this yet, could you give us a little taste of what is Silver in the Bone?
Yeah, so this is a book that I've been pitching. It took me a really long time to figure out the right pitch for this book. I actually had to rely on a friend to help me for some reason. Normally, I'm very quick with like, oh, it's like X meets Y. And then I started getting all my trade reviews for it. And like the trade reviews kept referencing the fact that it was like, you know, it's like romance and dark fantasy horror. And I'm like, I didn't write a horror novel. Like, what are you talking about? Because I am such a weenie about anything related to horror. I got like, I talked about this a lot on book tour, but I was like fully scarred by my experience of seeing The Ring in movie theaters when I was like in middle school. Mm-hmm. It like ever since then, I cannot engage with anything horror related. So I was like, I didn't write a horror novel, but actually I've been reading Anatomy of Genres by John Truby, who is sort of like a screenwriter story type coach. My favorite book on craft is by him. It's called Anatomy of a Story. A lot of my author friends are like fully on the John Truby train. We love John Truby, but he wrote, I had it behind. Oh, I actually still have it right behind me. I'll show you since we're talking on Zoom.
Yeah.
Thing is like a total brick. It is almost more of like a reference book.
Yeah.
But I was reading through the horror section of the genres book and I was like, oh, I think I did actually write a horror novel. But my friend actually was the one who pointed out that there is almost, well, I'll give you my like quick pitch for it, right? So it's like, if Indiana Jones was a teenage girl and it crosses over into Arthurian legend, but then there's also kind of like the essence of The Last of Us. Like she pointed that out to me and I was like, oh, I get it. And then reading the Anatomy of Genres, I was like, no, I really get it. I did accidentally somehow write a book that has some horror elements to it. It's like fantasy, myth, and horror. And some romance.
Yes.
Too.
And some romance.
Totally doom and gloom if you are not a horror person like me.
Yeah.
But so it's the bigger awesome. The bigger plot pitch for it is that it's centered on Tamsin, who has grown up in this kind of hidden world of treasure hunters along with her brother. And basically these treasure hunters all seek out magical relics that are, you know, from legends and mythology and folklore. And the one thing that she really desperately wants to find and can't is some sort of relic that's powerful enough to break the curse that is slowly but surely consuming her brother. And so when she gets wind of one of these relics existing, something known as the Ring of Dispel from Arthurian legend, and that her long missing guardian may have vanished while looking for it, she immediately sets off to go find this ring and of course is competing with others to find it as well, including her rival in the treasure hunting guild, who is handsome and infuriatingly charming, and a young sorceress, and her brother eventually joins in too. And their search takes them into the mystic otherland of Avalon, but Avalon is suffering from its own terrible curse. And soon they're not just searching for the ring, they are fighting to survive. So it is quite the journey for them. But yeah, it is a blend of a bunch of different genres, and hopefully there are some big twists that'll catch you guys off guard. But it took a really long time for this book to come together, and I'm really excited that readers are actually finally reading it.
Yeah, that must be so cool to like finally see it on the shelf. You're like, oh, there it is.
Yeah, you know, this is, I for a while I thought this was sounds so bad. I was really excited that Silver in the Bone, because it felt right. Like I was so excited that it was my 13th book. And then I actually counted and I was like, no, it's my 14th book. But it felt so right being the 13th book, being kind of like spooky and, you know, playing with superstitions and all of that too. So maybe it's my honorary 13th book.
Yes. But, I think we can. Yeah. We'll just say it's your 13th.
Yeah, we'll just, there we go. Yeah. But it's like what I started to say and then completely interrupted myself as per usual. It's just like, it never gets old to see a book like in finished hardcover form and then to be able to actually like put on your shelf. It's just really an amazing feeling.
I love it. And let me tell you, I am the horror person at the bookstore. Okay, listen, you. Yeah. The Children of the Night are terrifying.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they're so creepy.
They're so creepy. I love them. Yeah, I love them.
They're absolutely horrible.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's something about the way you refer to them just as the children is it just adds to the terror, because then it's like I'm picturing what they actually are, but then I'm also picturing evil children.
Yeah.
It just is.
I
so
love
scary.
Oh my gosh. I love this is again very random, but one of my favorite like Reddit subjects whenever I like see it come up like on the main Reddit page is like really creepy things children have said to you. I like love that genre of Reddit basically of like all of these like unintentionally super creepy things that children come out with sometimes.
Yeah.
But I do think like kids, I don't know. I do think that they have like this extra sense that we sort of lose as we get older, maybe. I don't know.
100%. Yeah. I have two very spooky children and it's just my life is I live in a horror novel. It's hilarious. yeah. One of my children sleptwalked and hid in her closet one time. Like I went into her room to look for her and she was just standing perfectly still inside her closet. Gosh. And I was just like, nope. Like all I could see was her little feet poking out. I was like, nope, I'm out. Nope.
She can hang out in there until she wakes up.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And I also love that it was the ring that totally scarred you on your horror journey, because it was the ring that made me a horror lover.
You know, I am like I've talked about it so much that I almost want to just like suck it up and go watch it again because I truly have not seen it since I saw it in theaters. And what year did
Wow.
that come out in? I'm trying to remember.
Oh gosh, it was like 02 maybe? 2001, 2002?
Yeah,
Something like
because
that.
I'm trying to remember how old I was when I saw it. I just remember like going to the movie theater and being so scared at the ending because it has one of those endings, and I love writing endings like this where something really awful has happened and you think that you've entered the sort of the falling, action, the like resolution stretch of the story. And then something really awful happens out of the blue, and it completely upends kind of your instinctive understanding of story and how story should be working and flowing and all of that. And it has one of those endings. I remember at the end being so scared. I had my hands like completely covering my face, and I was like sobbing and swearing. I was so scared. And part of the reason it was so scarring was that there was like this row of like really cute high school boys sitting directly behind me, and they were like laughing hysterically because I was just losing my ever-loving, you know what, like at this ending. And then I had to sleep with the lights on for 3 days and like cover the TV arm well, like that was going to keep her out. Like I was a mess after that movie. And I think like when you have an overactive imagination, which I'm guessing like most creative people do, like it just makes it 10 times worse because you're constantly imagining how it could happen to you or like what's lurking in the darkness and all of that too. So oh, that movie. I
It's
do
it
need to rewatch it though, I think,
it
just to see
it
if it's
holds up. It's still very scary.
Yeah, I remember it being like really beautifully shot too, just like from a pure cinematography point of view.
And it's one of those it, I also had a very traumatic experience with it, but I just decided to like own it, I guess, and it just became my personality for a while. But it was like all of the creepy little things that happen in the movie happened to me in real life after the movie ended.
Wait,
Like,
really?
it was, it like I, turned the movie. I watched it by myself in the middle of the night because I'm a crazy person. And I
Yeah,
turned
that is very brave. I will be honest with you.
it was a choice that I made. Yeah, not a good one, but I like turned the TV off. It was off. It was all the way off. As soon as I walked past the TV, it turned back on to static. And that was the beginning
Oh
of the end.
no.
I mean, it was, woke up to the phone ringing, the horse farm across the street, the horses start freaking out. There's randomly a ladder leaning up against my neighbor's house, leading to
Oh.
nothing. Like everything.
Oh
It
my
was just,
gosh.
but then, 7 days later, I showed it to all my friends at a Halloween party. So I was like, well, I'm good.
But you know what? Like some I maybe it's you did like your own version of exposure therapy, like where
Kind
you were
of.
like, I'm not gonna be scared. I'm just gonna like I'm gonna own it, I'm gonna embrace it, I'm gonna love it. Like that's honestly pretty badass. I am not that brave. I will be
It
completely honest.
was, yeah, I didn't want to be scared in front of all of my friends at the party. And so I got to, after I'd already watched it, I went and found like the closet scene, like the first jump
Oh my
scare.
gosh.
And I just
Yeah.
paused it and I just kept it on pause until it was so ridiculous that it was funny. And that helped.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, oh man, I don't know why I get so scared. It's like not, I'm just like, it's not that big of a deal. I'll explain. It's not real. It's not real, but somehow it feels like a really good story makes you feel that it's real and you're f experiencing the emotions as if it were real. So,
Absolutely.
and that's like obviously the goal of storytelling is that you almost enter this like hypnosis state when you're like really into the story itself and you're kind of experiencing this other reality that's just playing out in your mind or is playing out in this case on the screen. So, oh my gosh. Yeah, I've never really been a horror person, but I can appreciate the genre for what it offers.
Absolutely. And I love that your book has those elements, but then it also has the romance elements, because I do feel
Yeah.
like in some ways those, I like to say that they're peanut butter and chocolate. Like those two genres go really well together because they both play on like vulnerability and passion and like things like that. And man, I love an enemies to lovers romance.
I know. I know these two are like Tamsin and Emrys, who is her love interest in the story. They are so fun to write about because he is somebody who barely has to try and he can kind of get a rile out of her. Like, she riles very easily, you could say. Because she is, you know, it's just, she's just a very self-protective person to begin with. But one thing I really loved about writing them was that they both have what the other wants, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they have this conversation about it where he kind of perceives her life as being one of like total freedom, where she can, you know, she's not bound by this family legacy and having to like uphold these traditions and all of that, where she sees like him as being the lucky one for having this family and like knowing where he comes from, knowing kind of what his future is and having that stability. So it's, those two are very, very like, they're just so fun to write. And like their banter killed me while I was working on this book.
Yeah, I loved them. They were cracking me up. And yeah, as their relationship, you know, shifts and changes, I was just like, oh, you too.
Well, it's funny too, because like, I know one of the things that's come out of TikTok is really sort of leading with tropes in terms mm-hmm. of talking about projects. And so like, obviously one of the very popular tropes on book talk, and I think it was maybe born from fan fiction, is the mm-hmm. there's only one bed trope.
Oh, yes.
And I was like, in this book there's only one armoire that they can hide in. I don't know what the trope is for that. There's only one.
That's only one.
We have to squeeze in there together.
A confined
in the darkness.
Space. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh goodness. And it's cold and we have to huddle. Oh no.
I know. Oh no, it's so cold. We have to share body warmth.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I swear I felt like every single emotion reading this book. I was like, I was all over the place. I was like, this is great.
Yay. That makes me really happy. And it's so like, while I was on book tour, someone asked me like, what's your favorite part of publishing a book? And mm-hmm. I was like, oh man, to be like, to be honest, like, I want to say it's when the book is finally published and you can talk to readers about it. But for me, it's usually like the brainstorming process is my favorite part, because the story is just like completely open with possibilities and you're meeting the characters for the first time and discovering it. And then once the book is published, you sort of are surrendering it to readers and like, you love it, but you don't know if anybody else will love it.
Right.
And that's like sort of this like tricky emotional balance that you have to strike as an author. So to hear somebody say that they really love the book like makes me so happy. And it's also like kind of a relief after like just working on this story by myself.
Yeah.
And my editor, I shouldn't say completely by myself. But after working on it in such a solitary way for so long, to like hear people talking about the characters and the story, it's like really, really magical. So thank you.
Oh my gosh, you're welcome. Well, yes, I did. I loved it so much. And now you worked in publishing for a bit, right?
I did. When I went to college, I went to the College of William and Mary in Virginia. If you've ever been to Colonial Williamsburg, it's the school that's at one end of the main street, just to give you a sense of the vibes. But I went to school knowing that I wanted to major in English and in history. And my dad was, you know, very much of that, like, very practical generation of, like, you know, you get a job that it makes you, you know, financially stable. You get right. a well-paying job. And then you do your passions, like, on the side or after you retire. You know, he was like, yep. you know, you build that financial safety net. And so for him, like, even though I knew from a really young age that I wanted to be a writer, he was always sort of like, okay, that's very nice. He like didn't crush that dream, but he was like gently encouraging me to do something else in the meantime in case it didn't work out. He was like very practical as a person. And my mom was very much the same way. And so when I went to school, I had like every intention of going to law school. And I even took I took the LSAT. I sat in the middle of that LSAT and I was like, I had been hearing all of the people around me talking about like how excited they were to like go to law school. And I graduated right after. So like I graduated in 2009 from undergrad. So it was just right after the financial crisis of 2008.
Yeah.
And so I knew so many people were going into grad school to try to like put off entry in the workforce. And so I was in the middle of taking the LSAT and I just like suddenly sat back and was like, what am I doing here? I do not want to become a lawyer. I'm already negotiating with myself on like how I'm going to bail as soon as I can like pay back my student loans for becoming a lawyer. Like I'm doing this really to make my dad happy, to make my parents happy. Like I have to like take a risk. But I hadn't sold a book yet. I did end up selling a book my second semester of senior year. That was my little debut called Brightly Woven. Nice. It's a high fantasy novel that is no longer in print because the publisher closed. But after I sold that, I was like, okay, I have this like small nest egg where I can use that as my savings. And if my goal is ultimately to be able to write full time, I do actually need a job of some kind to give me health insurance, to help me build my savings and all of that. And so I have such a vivid memory of going to the career center with my like little resume and just being like, please help me. I don't know what to do. I'm like bailing on law school. This was the plan for 4 years. I'm someone who needs a plan. And the guidance counselor, career counselor? I don't know what the correct term is.
Career counselor.
Looked at it and was like, well, you know, you clearly already know so much about publishing, having done all of this research to try to get your book published. Like, have you ever thought about just working in publishing? And I had not, because I was not someone who ever wanted to live in New York City. I thought I'd be like very overwhelmed by that experience. I like did not have that like New York City fantasy of like hailing a cab out on the street, living that like Sex in the City lifestyle. I was just like not that person. Very introverted and still am. And so just by like pure coincidence, my undergrad had scholarships for the publishing courses. So I think there's one at Columbia, there's one at NYU, and I think there's one in Denver. I'm not sure what the university it is through, but it's basically like a couple week long seminar crash course into publishing where you kind of go and you like are listening to lectures from people who work in publishing. And at the end, there's a big job fair. So I did the Columbia publishing course, which was really interesting and really fun and had a lot of very interesting guest speakers, including Megan Tingley, who's the head of Little Brown Books for Young Readers. I think she's still the head. She was like Stephanie Meyer's editor for Twilight. And she talked a lot about that. And so I was like, okay, I really want to continue trying to publish my own work. So I got to like not be an editorial assistant. I was like one of the only people in that program who did not have their heart set on becoming an editorial assistant or editor in the long run, because I knew that editors end up taking a lot of their work home with them and read on the weekends and edit on the weekends. And I was like, I can't do that and also be a writer. But the first job that was offered to me, of course, was like an editorial assistant. So I was like, I better take this job because I need to like pay my rent. I like have been living here off of my savings now for a couple of weeks. I got to like make this happen. So I started as an editorial assistant. I mostly worked on like middle grade and picture books. So like younger readers. And yeah, I always say it was like a lot of like boogers, like a lot of bugs, a lot of like sports. just like very fun, like middle grade projects, basically. And then I eventually moved into school library marketing, which gave me a little bit more freedom. And I got to travel in and out of the city a lot more because we would go to all of the, you know, like the American Library Association conference and would have a booth there and book talk. So that is my very long, rambly story of how I ended up working in publishing. But I was in publishing for maybe, I want to say, I should just figure out the math on this. I know. I think I worked in publishing. It would have been from 2009 to 2014-ish.
Oh, wow. Okay. Like
5-6 years. And then at that point, the Darkest Mind series, like the last book in that trilogy, was coming out. And that's when I finally felt like I had enough of a safety net to quit my job and write full time. And that's was becoming too hard to like meet deadlines with like travel for work and all of that too. So
yeah.
Once I kind of had my safety net figured out, I was able to leave my day job. But I loved working in publishing, and I'm lucky enough to publish with the publisher now that I had worked at. And so I'm working with a lot of the same people. Yeah. It's been really fun. Yeah.
like a little like homecoming.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I have so much respect for editors and stuff. I'm just like, I mean, I read a lot, you know, as a bookseller. Yeah. I'm constantly reading, but
to, I think booksellers might even read more than the
too. Possibly.
So you have my full respect there. It's it's a lot of reading. And but it's like fun. It's just like, I think as an editor too, you're just rereading the same project over and over and over again too. So it's that is slightly less fun than getting to read a bunch of new stuff as it's coming out. But
Oh man. Yeah. Oof. Yeah. I don't think I could do the editing thing. I think I would like it at first and then I'd be like, oh, okay. I'm going to go read something else now.
Yeah. It's kind of funny because I always say like editing and writing, like the actual drafting, it's like two very different parts of your brain. And so my brain has always been stronger, I think, on the drafting side than on the editing side. And so I have a lot of admiration for editors because, and I mean, that was another reason to not stay in that editorial assistant position where like I was able to learn so much on the job about publishing and book production and all of that. And, but on the other hand, I was like, this is not my strength. I should not be in this position.
You're like, and I'm out.
I was like, somebody else who really desperately wants to be an editor should have this job. Because it is a long slog too. That's the other thing I think people don't necessarily realize about editors is that it's a long climb up to becoming like a full-fledged editor. So you're like an editorial assistant, then you're an assistant editor, then you are an editor, but then like it's just so many like years of learning on the job and acquiring projects and slowly but surely building your list. It really, editors have my full respect. Yeah, and so much of their job now too is not even just editing, it's, you know, writing copy and doing presentations and all of that too. So publishing has changed so much in the last 10 years. It's really wild.
Truly, it is. It feels very fluid right now. Every time there's like a new social media boon, it's like, okay, how is this affecting publishing and like now, marketing?
I know, like, AI has been like a really big conversation with a lot of my author friends about like, you know, protecting our intellectual property and our authorly voice and how do we do that? And I know, you know, like publishers having gone through the pandemic, they still have not fully worked out, you know, supply chain issues and all of that too. So it's like, it's been a rough couple years in publishing for sure. But I think, you know, it's exciting too that nothing ever stays the same. I could maybe do with not having to be a video editor director to promote my books. Like that's maybe a change I don't love that's happened in the last 10 years. But
I definitely have like made mental notes of some of my author friends who I know like don't, they're very shy because author, we're, you know, you're all introverts. And like, I've definitely made mental notes of like, okay, like, I know that they are like terrified of TikTok and like they don't want to promote. So I'm just going to like, I'll promote their book on our TikTok. Like I'll do a little extra because I'm just like, these poor authors, they did not sign up for this.
That's so nice of you. Because I think like there are certain authors, like my friend Victoria Aveyard is so good on TikTok. Like
she's really
it comes like very naturally to her. She's like a very naturally funny person. She says she's very introverted, but I think she's actually quite outgoing and she has like the right personality for this. And I like every time I log on to TikTok, I get like very anxious. Like I can feel my like pulse increasing essentially because unlike Instagram and even Twitter to a certain extent, like you can't really like protect yourself from seeing negative things about your book on TikTok in the same way that you can like filter and untag yourself on like Instagram, for example. So like, I remember when my book Lore came out, this was like 2021, I finally signed up for TikTok and I posted a couple videos. And because I had posted about Lore, they were showing me videos about Lore. So I got like one really nice one. And then I got one really mean one. And I was I'm out. No. I can't do it. I'm I'm too petal soft. As Taylor Swift said, I'm just too soft for all of it. Like I can't. But I mean, book selling has changed so much too in the last 10 years. And like the fact that you guys all have these BookTok accounts too, TikTok accounts, and you're on social and you're like creating, but like, it's kind of, I don't know. Do you like it? Do you feel like it helps connect you with readers? Like
I do. Yeah, I like it. And we were sort of we were an early TikTok kind of we jumped on that train pretty early on.
Yeah.
Basically I downloaded it for myself in, you know, the early days of the pandemic and just kind of was like making mental notes. And then after about like 6 months, then I created the bookstore account and I posted every single day for like a year. I just
Wow,
something,
that's a,
just
I
whatever
mean,
it
that's a
was.
ton of work.
It was a lot of work. There were days when I would come in and I would record like 15 different TikToks in the store just so that I would have like things to post.
Yeah.
I don't do that anymore. I post like when inspiration strikes, which is fine. But, you know, it's, and I kind of found my groove with it. Like I kind of was like, oh, I really like doing, you know, like a silly lip syncing trend and making it apply to books. But like, I also really like just recording my own staff picks, like, and
Yeah.
just being like, here's a book I liked, which is obviously much easier to do because I can just read my review.
Yeah, I think that's one of the
So.
like n the really nice things about BookTok. I know I've now made it sound like I am not a BookTok person. I admire and respect it. I
Yeah.
constantly am wondering if it's like maybe not just it maybe it's just not a space for authors. It's like a reader space and maybe we can like join in occasionally.
Yeah.
I think about that a lot too. Like what's an author space? What's a reader space? What's an author and reader space where we can
Yeah.
coexist peacefully together and not
Yep.
have any hurt feelings or have people feel like they have to like mince their words or, you know, but
Yeah.
I will say like I think one of the things that BookTok has done for authors in general is that it gives another kind of book talking outlet. And like the books that have gone really, really viral have gone viral with readers posting reviews. It's not really
Yes.
anything the author has done on their end necessarily. I
Yeah.
think I'm thinking of like Addie LaRue. That was like
Yeah.
one of the first books, The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue. Sorry, I was like, not The Secret Life, The
Yeah.
Invisible Life of Addie LaRue. That was like one of
Yeah.
the first books that I remember kind of going viral on TikTok from a reader review. And I think that is like amazing when it happens. I don't know if it still
Yeah.
happens now, but.
It does. We have definitely seen kind of this new wave of readers that like probably these people were already readers, but it just feels like there's more readers right now because
Yeah.
of book talk. And I think there's a lot of, you know, the you know, because it's TikTok, it just shows up on your FYP. Like whether you're looking for book stuff or not, like eventually you're gonna see someone talking about a book. And I think more and more people are like, oh, that actually sounds really interesting. Are books cool,
Yeah.
actually?
Yeah, I
So,
really
you
think
know.
that is. That's like kind of what's happened. It's like subtly influenced people back into reading. And the other thing I've really noticed too is that it's given this like very equal platform to both like traditionally published authors and indie published authors. And
Yes,
now it's sort
definitely.
of, I think a lot of my friends who are indie authors now have a way to directly speak to potential readers.
Yeah.
And it like makes their books feel a lot more accessible. Whereas
Yeah.
before, I feel like a lot of the indie authors were having to rely a lot on just advertising, pure advertising, and
Absolutely.
trying to get people onto
Self-promotion.
like, yeah. And now there's like this whole new element of discovery, where they're not, you know, working with the same budgets as like a traditionally or, you know, in a perfect world, a traditional publisher when it comes
Yeah.
to advertising. So it's been really
Yeah.
cool to see that change in the industry too, that there are like these two very
Absolutely.
viable paths.
And I love like coming at it from as, you know, as the indie bookstore, like if I see one of those pop up and I can say like, oh, that's actually something we can carry.
Yeah.
And like I can post about it and be like, hey, look, your book is on our shelves. And like, and then they're like, oh my God, I'm in a bookstore. Like
Yeah.
you get these kind of like fun little author relationships with these people who were like, I never thought my book would see the light of day. And here it is on a bookshelf, like for people to shop. Like, I just, it's,
Yeah.
I do think there are pros and cons to book talk, but I think the pros are really, really nice. They're
Yeah.
really fun.
Yeah. I try to focus for sure more on the pros because I know
Yeah.
that there are absolutely cons. There are cons to everything too.
Yeah.
I know, like, one of the cons that I've seen come up a lot is that BookTok kind of recommends the same books to people over and over again. Like you can kind of tell what books are loved by the algorithm, that that's like the constant. It's like much harder for authors of color to kind of like break into, like it's the discussions around just like what books are visible on TikTok and what books aren't are really interesting and troubling and all of that. So it's definitely something that I am aware of as being a big con of book talk, but I think like on the whole, it has been a positive force.
Yeah.
Honestly, would you agree? I don't know. Again, I'm not on book talk enough to
totally
know. I know,
I
like
think we get enough people who they come in and they, you know, see a book that they saw on book talk, and then, you know, we as booksellers can be like, oh, and if you like that, here's a whole stack of other books that you would not have found on book talk. And that's kind of where, that's one thing that like I try to on book talk, I try to follow as many bookstores as possible and authors as possible. Cause I know the reviewers are going to just kind of show up, but it's like, if I can be interacting with the other booksellers who are like, here's 10 things to read if you liked, you know, Addie LaRue, like here's whatever. And you know, we're highlighting authors of color and marginalized communities and things like that. And that's like the more promotion we can do on book talk, but also just like in the real world, really helps. Because we've absolutely gotten a bunch of new like semi-regular customers, these like teenagers who come in all the time now, because like we had a book talk display and it was like, if you like this, read this. And now they come in all the time and they're like, like I just read this one. It was really good. And I'm like, excellent. Read this one next.
That makes me so happy. Yeah. Cause I remember like, one of the things a couple of my author friends and I have been talking about too, is like, one of the things that's really changed post pandemic is that when you would go to like a book signing, you would kind of know everybody there because like the bookstores have their own little community of readers who would kind of come out to each and every event. And, you know, they had their own book clubs and all of that too. And I think book talk has kind of revived that a little bit, and that it's bringing in more regular customers, as you were saying, and it's like getting people back into the habit of going to book events and coming in for new, you know, new releases or putting holds on or, you know, requesting books and all of that too. It sort of has revived the book community culture. It's been like really pleasant to see. Yeah,
it is. No, it's really good to see. And we, you know, we absolutely saw like in 2020, obviously it's like, okay, well, we're not open to the public, but like, here's our website. And like, here's some things that we've been reading that we recommend. And like, we definitely saw the community like come out in force. And then it was like, okay, now we're back open now. So we went fully digital, right, with like virtual events and all this stuff. And then it was like, now it's like, okay, so we're going to try to come back to the bookstore, come see the authors in person again. And so it's like, it's been this kind
of walk into the doors, please.
And they have, luckily, because, you know, a lot of the people who supported us when we went like fully virtual are now like, oh my God, I'm in the bookstore again. And there's been a lot of enthusiasm there, but like, it's been a weird few years.
And I think like in some ways the industry was kind of due for, publishing is like kind of weirdly old fashioned in certain ways. I know like on the business side of it, the way that like deals are structured, it feels very kind of old fashioned, even for the longest time, like getting a job in publishing is like an old boys network where like the only way to really get a job was if you knew somebody. So you had to like work your alumni connections, or you had to like really like know a family friend or a friend of a friend who was already there who could pass your resume on. And I think like one of the positive things that the pandemic has brought about, in addition to all of these discussions about making, you know, the companies, the book publishers themselves more inclusive, but like publishing more inclusive books, more diverse books, I think the fact that now my publisher, I publish with Random House Kids, specifically the Knopf imprint, They're like, Penguin Random House is one of the publishers that's like not requiring their employees to come back into the office if they don't want to. And so when I worked at Random House Kids, we were spread out over maybe like, I want to say 3 floors maybe, where it was like, I'm trying to remember exactly how many. And now the entire children's division is down to a single floor because so few people come into the office. So it's really opened up the potential for people to work in publishing, working remotely. Whereas like one of the, I think the biggest barriers to working in the publishing industry was always the cost of living in New York City.
Yeah.
I think about this a lot, that if I did not have a dad who could, be the guarantor on my like apartment lease, because New York, the requirements are, I'm not sure if it's still the same, but you know, when I was apartment hunting with my friends, and you know, we were living in a 2-bedroom that we converted, I think illegally, into a 3-bedroom. We were like, just like, we were like really playing fast and loose with like when this requirement went into effect. I think we like maybe got grandfathered in. But you know, you're still paying. When I was living with two other people, I think my lowest rent was like $1,200 for not a big apartment at all. And that's like on top of, you know, just increased cost of living, food is more expensive and all of that. And publishing, you know, the salaries have gotten significantly better, thankfully, but the starting salary at Harper when I started there was like $30,000 before taxes, and you pay city and state taxes and federal taxes.
Oh god.
So it was like,
oh no.
It just the cost of living in New York is like really tough. Like you can it. You can make it work. You have to be pretty strict with yourself. And you know, if I hadn't had like the ultimate safety net of my parents, but also the safety net of having sold that first book and having some savings, I think I would have gotten into trouble a couple of times, because you really do, you know, you're like one bad injury away from being in financial peril, basically living in New York when you're first starting in publishing. And so now it just has opened it up to so many more people who do not have to live in New York. Like you can work fully remote.
I love that. I think that's I think that's amazing. Like it's definitely been the shift that we needed to get new different voices in there. Here's people from all over who can be here and
I know.
Again, and not get crushed by New York.
I know. And it's like, you know, publishing, like any other industry, it's like a business. There's still a long ways to go to making things feel truly like equitable. And, you know, I think at least it seems like the publishers are trying to like move us forward into the future, which even 10 years ago, it just feels like a completely different industry to me now. So yeah, it's, the pandemic definitely accelerated a lot of these changes. That was a very long tangent. I'm sorry.
No, I love it. I love being able to talk about the industry with people who are, you know, in the industry.
Yeah, yeah. And I, you know, it's, I will say, like, I love everybody I work with in publishing. It can be kind of like a thankless job sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
And everybody is working on so many books all the time, multiple lists, and they're doing it because they love it. So it really, sorry, I just hit my watch or something. But yeah, on the whole, I think it is, you know, I love the publishing industry. I feel very grateful to be able to be a writer and write full time.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we obviously still have a long way to go on certain fronts, and hopefully we'll get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think it comes down to like, we're in this industry because we're passionate about it, right? It's like, there aren't, the vast majority of people who are in the book industry are not, you know, making millions. And so we're in it because we love books and we love readers and we, you know, love bringing these words to the people who need them, right? And so I think And with each generation being more and more kind of like progressive and with a mind to activism and change, I think we're going to see big changes over a very like quick time period. Like I think we're going to see as like millennials and Gen Z are taking over publishing, it's like we're going to see some big changes.
I mean, I will say like I feel like no disrespect to my fellow millennials, I feel like many of you guys out there will probably agree with this statement. I kind of think it's mostly Gen Z leading the charge on a lot of this. Gen Z really refuses to settle for a less than ideal work situation.
Yeah.
I think because of like when millennials were graduating and the financial crisis and all of that, it does feel like it was so hard to get any job when we graduated that we were just like grateful for
I'll
any.
Take it. Yeah.
Yeah. We're like, please don't make it work. It'll be fine. And I think we can all learn something from Gen Z, really insisting on a good quality of life. I really respect them for leading the charge on that. Cause I definitely am one of those millennials that's like, thank you. Thank you for whatever meager offerings you will give me. I shouldn't laugh, but it's like, I think millennials have had like such a interesting young adulthood.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Just one historical event after another.
I know. I was like, I'd like to live in less interesting times, please.
Mm-hmm.
Just for a couple years. But
Yeah. No, for sure. No, I'm right there with you. So I do want to talk just a little bit more about your book because I love it so much and I want everyone to read it. So first I have to ask, so it has Arthurian retelling in it, in its DNA. It's got Arthur in its DNA. Do you have a favorite Arthurian retelling? Because I feel like there's been a lot recently. Like I feel like it came up into kind of the zeitgeist in the last like 5 or 10 years. So is there one that you really, really love?
The one that really knocked my socks off was Legendborn by Tracy Dion. Have you read that?
Yes.
It's really, really good. And then the second book is out.
Bloodmarked.
Yeah. Yes. I haven't read it yet because
this
is like one of the torturous things about writing, being an author is like, for me, I don't want to read anything that's like too close to what I'm working on at the time. And so I had read, Legendborn, that's my dog Tennyson, sorry, in the background. He will target any living creature that dares to cross the boundary of our front yard.
I mean, valid.
I mean birds. I had read Legendborn. I had like a little book club during the pandemic, just with some readers, and we had read it during that before I had really actively started drafting Silver in the Bone. And so like once I started working on this series, I was like, okay, I gotta like wait until I'm done editing the sequel. Yeah. Then read the sequel of Legendborn Bloodmarked. But it's fantastic. It's like a really fun, just like not even reimagining necessarily. I'm trying to think of how I would put this because it's not really a retelling, but it is like, it's something that I love doing in my own work, which is like, you have this body of myths and legends, and Arthurian legend is like vast. It's sort of, Tracy talks about this too, that it's sort of like the original fan fiction where like for a while everyone was kind of taking a crack at it.
Yeah.
And you see how it gets kind of revived, you know, over the centuries. It had like, it was really big during the Victorian age for a while. And just like the different roles the myths played within society and kind of like, but I think what she does and what I love to do in my stories too is to use these myths to tell like a new story rather than just do a retelling. Not that there's anything wrong with retellings. I love a good retelling. Okay. But it's just like a different way of approaching the story. And so, yeah, it's not like repurposing is not the right word. I'm trying to think of how I would let's say reimagining. Let's go with reimagining,
we'll
even though
that.
It's not a retelling. It's a reimagining of.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's, this book ended up being, you know, the characters are wonderful. It's so moving. I really highly recommend it if you have not read it. If you're one of the few people out there who have not read Legendborn, please read Legendborn.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. It is so, it's so cathartic too.
Yeah.
I feel like it's like a good book for right now. It's like, you know what? We all have a little bit of rage in us. Here you go.
That's another really good audiobook that I listened to on audiobook as I was walking and doing everything. So I recommend that audiobook if you are an audiobook listener.
Absolutely.
But yeah, there's been, gosh, there's been a lot. I think there's even, so I'm trying to think. I think it's called My Name is Morgan. There's like a Ooh. Sort of like Cersei-esque reimagining of Morgan Le Fay, or Morgana, cool. if you will, Morgan. Yeah. Coming out maybe later this year.
Excellent.
I want to say. Excellent. But yeah, I'll
keep an eye out for that.
It's really interesting. I know, like, for me, I wanted to approach it from a slightly different angle because so much of Arthurian legend is centered on the idea of brotherhood.
Right.
With like the Knights of the Round Table and the relationship between Arthur and like Lancelot and all of that. And all of those stories are so interesting to read and to read the different iterations of them. But I really wanted to focus on Avalon and the idea of sisterhood and come at it from that side. And it's really interesting to me that there's not actually that much written about Avalon. There's just not a lot of content about Avalon in the existing kind of Arthuriana writing. So it was really fun and kind of an interesting challenge to just imagine it kind of from the ground up and go from there.
Yeah, I loved the angle that you took. I thought it was so cool because, you know, when you're kind of reading like the generic, like, oh, and it's an Arthurian tale, and I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then I was like listening to it and I was like, oh, wait, this is cool. Like, it was like totally like kind of like to the side of Arthur. Like, it was like, it was over here. And this is awesome.
You do get to see Arthur in the book. Just possibly but he's like not over in there. The way that you were expecting.
No.
There is one night.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. This book, I can't remember if I already said this out loud, but like every single time I thought I knew where you were going, you just like pulled the rug up from underneath me. And I was like, oh, okay. We're over here now.
Yes.
It was great.
I know. I love a big twist. I really do. And I think the best twists are the ones where it completely upends the main character's like understanding of themselves and their understanding of the situation. And so I really look for those moments within the story to just like completely pull the rug out from under poor Tamsin. And I love a big like midpoint twist too.
Oh, but
yeah, the ending of this one, I was like, I had to write it over the course of like a couple of days because I was like, I can't sit down and just like hammer this all out. This is a lot even for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Have your tissues ready. It's a lot. It's a lot going on. My heart was like, oh boy. No, it's fantastic. Oh my gosh. Alex, I could clearly talk to you all day long. Like I love this book. I love chatting with you. This is amazing. But I will not make you stay on the Zoom call all day long.
Well, I had a wonderful time chatting with you. So thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And I'm gonna go chuck this at some people who need to read it.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. It was nice meeting you.
You too.
Hopefully I'll get to visit the store one day.
Definitely. You're welcome anytime.
Okay.
Anytime.
All right. Well, have a good rest of your afternoon. Thank you again too. For having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bye, Alex.
See you later. Bye.
Huge thanks again to Alex Bracken for joining me on the podcast. Silver in the Bone is available now from Gibson's Bookstore. You can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. For a shoppable list of all the books we discussed during this episode, you can click the link in our show notes or go to gibsonsbookstore.com/laydown-books. Make sure you're following us on your favorite social media platforms. We're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. All of those links will be in the show notes. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the bookstore. Bye!